the tactic of Satan and the church at Smyrna, or toward the church at Smyrna, was quite different than the tactic that he used toward the church at Pergamos. If the church at Smyrna describes or depicts the period of persecution in the second century when the church was tried to the utmost by Satan and all of his violence, the church of Pergamos depicts the period when the world became friendly toward the church and seduced her into its worldliness. The two tactics that we find in these two churches are long been Satan's tactics. He used them with the children of Israel, and they find it here. And that is that he appears as a roaring lion in violence, and then he appears as a subtle serpent, corrupting and seducing the Lord's people. Smyrna, he raised persecution against the church with an attempt to stamp out Christianity. But the whole thing really backfired in that it only demonstrated to the world the reality of the Christian faith, for they were willing to die for it. And so it helped promulgate the reality of the Christian faith to the world, and many got saved. But in Pergamos, he changes his tactics, as we've already mentioned. And here he tries to enter the Christian ranks and to corrupt the church. This is what happened in the time of Constantine. When Christianity was popularized and many of the pagan in the world and the empire, the Roman Empire at that time, were brought to embrace Christianity, even though they were not real Christians in heart.
Could we say that in Smyrna there was a limit to how long it could last, 10 days. But in Pergamos, character ran right on, right through to the end. It's still around today. It really developed into Thyatira. So that I would suppose the second tactic in Pergamos was more subtle than the first one. Just trying to stamp it out. More subtle and more dangerous. I think that would be right.
Yes. You see it worked on in Joshua, on the children of Israel, these same two tactics. Joshua 9. The children of Israel entered the land of Canaan, and the Canaanites gathered themselves together in the first couple of verses, and they came out to fight against the children of Israel, to resist them with violence and with fighting, which would be that lion-like character that we've been speaking of. Joshua 9, it says, it came to pass when all the kings that were on this side of Jordan, in the hills, the valleys, and all the coast, the great sea over against Lebanon, the Hittite, the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, the Jebusite, heard thereof, they gathered themselves together to fight with Joshua, with Israel, with one accord. But then, from verse 3 to the end of the chapter, we have the second tactic. They tried to fight, and we know the result. The result was that they were defeated. Joshua, with the power of Jehovah, defeated these armies. And while they're being defeated, the enemy came up with a second tactic, and that was try to infiltrate their ranks and to corrupt them. And so you read the story of the Gibeonites, who pretended that they had come from a far country, and they made a league with them, and they became part of the children of Israel in name. And then they found out that they had received these persons who were really liars, and it brought a great deal of curse upon the children of Israel as a result. And they had to bear that curse and the fruit of it for many generations thereafter. You can read it in your spare time. So it's not a new tactic that we find the enemy working with here.
I think the key to that passage that you mentioned is in verse 4, where it says, they did work wilily. Yeah. And that's exactly what happens here in Pergamos. Satan is working wildly rather than out in the open.
It really shows us the power that Satan has in this world, and that he is indeed the god of this world by popular demand. We know that Constantine, we read history, we see that initially he looked at things and he could see that the Christians really made better citizens than the pagans. And so he decided, well, we're going to make them all Christians then, having no understanding of what Christianity really was. And so he, in order to promote things, being a political man and being trained in that area, he would put Christians in high places of authority. And so people that wanted to get into places of authority in the country, that's exactly what they'd have to do, become Christians, so-called. And history tells us that thousands and thousands of people were flocking to become Christians any way they could. And of course they taught baptism was one way to do it, and there was many things like that, that these people were doing anything they could to become Christians. And so he made Christianity the status quo, I guess you'd call it, or he made it legal, and then he imposed it also upon the people, and which is not God's way at all. But there's one thing that we often forget, and that is we forget what the world is. Here in Smyrna, the few verses before, the world had been killing them, torturing them. That same world now sticks out its hand and says, come on in. Come on back home. It's okay now. And the church said, okay, no problem. And here's the result. And I appreciate your comment, Gordon, about Thyatira. This really does, this is the seeds of Thyatira here. A lot of the festivals and a lot of the confusion and mix-up that we generally associate with Thyatira really started here.
Yeah.
And, you know, as you read in history, you think of things that we like to think of as being more properly connected with Thyatira and Catholicism really started prior to that, right here. And so it is our association with the world that will install in our lives some just terrible things. And so we need to be on guard, as we can see this assembly coming under this attack. So we individually come under this attack too, don't we?
Very fitting that the word Pergamos should mean marriage, because it's at this time that the church nominally married the world, in a sense, became linked up with an unholy union, and the barriers of separation, which were for the church's good and blessing, were broken down. It is interesting to notice, and I think it's good for us to get a little background, as you mentioned, Wayne. Maybe I could add a couple comments too, that when Constantine came to the throne, his mother was a Christian, and so he was, to satisfy her, he was a little bit easy on the Christians. And so when he came to the throne, he proclaimed that men could worship with the freedom of conscience. That was in 313, I believe, A.D. And for about a dozen years, Christianity was just another one of the many religions in the empire. But having the freedom of conscience to worship, Constantine, and many others, of course, became exposed to the Christian teachings. And being a very discerning emperor, he, like Wayne mentioned, he figured out that Christians make an awful lot better subjects in the empire than these pagans who are always raising insurrections and uncontrollable because they were not governed by order. Whereas a Christian, he submitted to the powers that be. He even prayed for the powers that be. They lived quiet, peaceable lives. He thought that would be perfect. So I could solidify my empire. So then he made a proclamation, I think it was 324, that he was going to make his whole empire, everybody had to be Christian. Which was quite a turnaround from the days of the persecution when the Christians were being confronted with
giving up their Christianity and taking up with paganism. Now the pagans were put to the sword, and they said, either Christianity or the sword, either baptism or the sword. And interestingly, you don't find the pagans saying, I'll be glad to die for my pagan belief. They opted for baptism. So it showed the unreality of those things as opposed to the reality that was shown in Smyrna when the Christians were put to that test. So at any rate, thousands and thousands of pagans nominally took up the name of Christ by being baptized, or the children were christened, I think. And paganism was outlawed from the empire, which meant that all these gorgeous temples and these places where they worshipped and went on with their idolatry were now left empty. And the Christians were upheld as being the one religion of the empire. They got to thinking, well, let's give these temples over to the Christians and let them worship there instead of having them worship in houses and so on. And so the world stuck out its hand to the Christian and said, you can have these beautiful decorated buildings. So Christianity moved into, I think one writer said, at the age of the golden slipper. They slipped on and came into all of these decorated temples, and they began to worship in that way. The problem was that so many who were now nominally Christian, they weren't in real belief, but they were in name only, they still wanted to hang on to their pagan festivals and their feast days and some of their practices. So they had to, and they did, begin to alter some of the pagan festivals and give them Christianized names and go along with the buildings. And so Christianity became very paganized at that time as a result. And this is where many of these things like Christmas got its introduction into Christianity. Prior to that, it was just a pagan feast. But they didn't want to give up that, so they Christianized it, gave it a Christianized name, and pagans went on with their newfound religion, and they had all of their pagan practices, and Christianity, the true church, swallowed the bait and became worldly. It's a sad, sad history.
So, it's that way today. Result of all that.
Yeah.
After all these centuries, they use the same dates
that
the pagans used for their festivities. They had a collision, though, at when, I guess, papacy came in. With religious leaders, they had a problem, though, at the end of the year was their big celebration, the new year they always had and pagans had all over Europe, world, I guess. They wanted to set up a one for the birth of Christ, and they wanted to use it. So they did. They just set it back a week, and they got by that way. So that's where they got the 25th of December from. Set it back a week so they wouldn't collide too much with the heathen celebrations. Simple as that.
Although Constantine took a very strong stand in supporting Christianity, he never really gave up his position as being the head high priest of the heathen thing. And that's where you get in verse 13, I know thy works and where thou dwellest, even where Satan's seat is. And that's really the place that Constantine still held. He held that position of being the head of the pagan high priest or whatever that particular title was. And he, at least for a period of time, went on with these things together. But he had adopted divinity of the Lord Jesus Christ. And that's where you get, he has not denied my, thou holdest fast my name, and has not denied my faith.
Satan's throne, right?
Yeah, right.
The
Satan's throne.
His throne and his realm is this world. Wayne already mentioned it. He's called the God of this world. And he's called the Prince of this world, too. So he is reigning and ruling in this world. And here we find this poor church dwelling in that very place where Satan is ruling. And so that's where we get the thought that the church settles down, gives up her pilgrim character, and settles down in the world.
Well, I think it's a religious world, isn't it? A religious world that I've got.
I'm just going to say that, so after hearing all this departure from what we get from the condition with Smyrna, it's no small wonder that in verse 12 it says, "These things said he which hath a sharp sword with two edges." It's going to come in and wield the sword.
So with that condition of things, how does a person decipher between what is of the world and what's of Christ, what is Christian? And so you get confusion all over, which is another name for Babylon. And Babylon develops out of all this. It's a tremendous thought. It's more than we can grasp, really.
We say that persecution is over with.
In a sense, it wasn't. It was not over with for those who would not submit to this terrible mixture of things. We see that there was a man in the end of verse 13. "Even in those days wherein Antipas was my faithful martyr, who was slain among you where Satan dwelleth." Well, his name means against all. He was against the mixture of things. And he lost his life for it. So when Satan does something, he does it with a lot of force, a lot of energy. And this man here, we don't really know much about him except for that he was faithful and he wouldn't go along with it.
Originally it was probably one man, as you mentioned, but it does have the typical carries with it the typical meaning that there was at that time a remnant, you know, of the ones who stood against this corruption and did not want to relinquish the pilgrim character and all of the worldliness that was flooding into the church. It is interesting to notice, though, where he was slain, as you mentioned, Wayne, among you. You, he's speaking to the church at Pergamos and the leaders particularly. And that's quite a change. The Christians were being slain by the world in Smyrna, and now the church, so-called, is slaying Christians. It's worse. Now, we realize that these ones who were practicing this kind of thing were probably only Christian in name only, having been baptized or Christendom or something like that. But still, bearing the name of Christ, martyring those who are seeking to be faithful. What a sad condition of things.
You get those two groups mentioned in verse 16, where it mentions about, "I will come unto thee and will fight against them." There's two different groups there, is there not? One refers to the church, and the them would refer to those who are the enemies. And the sword would be used on them.
There is a responsible element in the assembly whom God holds responsible to search out and to use that double-edged sword on such things as bad doctrine and evil teachers and immoral behavior and so on. And it's a shame for... And this is really what I believe he's saying here, that it is really a shame upon them that if they don't do it, that the Lord himself will finally come in and do it. And so he says, them. He says, I will pass judgment on them. But he says, if I have to, it's a shame on you, because you're going to be very seriously affected by it. And I think that's a good word for us today. For whatever reason, that we don't pass judgment on things that are not according to his mind. He'll eventually take up with it, and it may be quite some time, but the cost will be pretty much more than we can bear.
And that one word says it all, doesn't it? In verse 16, repent, or else I will come unto thee quickly.
As you mentioned, Wayne, it says, thou holdest fast my hand and not denied my faith. That is, that the essential fundamentals of the Christian faith were not attacked at this time. They still believed that Christ was the eternal Son of God. They stood against Arianism, which was that evil teaching that's still around today, that Christ was not God the Son, deity in deity. But their practice had gone to the wind. And you get in verses 14 and verses 15 the doctrine of Balaam and the doctrine of the Nicolaitans. These things were prevalent at this time. The doctrine of Balaam is, if you have to turn back to the Old Testament, you'll see there that Balaam was a prophet that was hired by the Moabite king Balak to try to curse and to stop the children of Israel from making progress through the wilderness into the promised land. And the Lord overruled it. They couldn't do it. So when Balaam failed in doing that, on his departing from Balak and going his own way, he taught him a doctrine. And he said, try to corrupt them. Bring them into association with yourselves through corruption, and that will bring judgment upon them. And so it says here that he taught them two things: to cast a stumbling block before the children of Israel, to eat things sacrificed to idols, and to commit fornication. And this is exactly what happened. They held a big feast, and they invited all the children of Israel to come out. And there was gross immorality taking place, and they were offering to their idols and so on. And that, in principle, was really what was being taught in the Church of Pergamos. If you want to say it in a nutshell, what is the doctrine of Balaam? The doctrine of Balaam is to encourage worldliness. For we're to understand that the sacrificing to idols is to participate in fellowship with what is idolatrous, which is what they did when they took over those heathen temples and brought in these heathen feasts and so on, and gave them Christianized names. And then to commit fornication is to speaks to us of what? Intercourse with this world. And this is what the church was encouraged through the doctrine of Balaam to do. To take up with the heathen feasts and so on, giving them Christian names to give it a good exterior, and also to go on hand in hand with the world. And the doctrine of Balaam is still in the church today. I mean, all these feasts are still there. Dad's already mentioned that. I think Chris was doing a study on where Easter came from. And I think he brought it right back to these early centuries, that men had brought this in. It's got nothing to do with the Word of God. And worldliness, of course, in the church is reached a new high.
And the Jezebel character referred to later on as we, as you go along, develop into that, and that Thyatira Jezebel character. Teach and seduce my servants to commit fornication, to eat things sacrificed to idols. In verse 20.
Before our time closes, I wonder if you could comment on that verse 17.
The doctrine of Nicolaitan?
No. To him that overcometh, will I give thee the hidden manna?
No, I don't know if we have time, but
Isn't that a reward given to have secret fellowship with the Lord for those who overcome? Isn't that the thought? Because Christ is the true manna, the one that can really feed the soul. Well, we talked about the doctrine of Balaam, and we haven't got to the talking about the doctrine of Nicolaitans. Maybe next week we can take some of these things up and look at them more particularly.